This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Earth-like planets have been making the headlines lately. First, there was Proxima B, the exoplanet orbiting our closest star. And now we have the Earth-sized Ross 128b that is steadily speeding toward Earth, a marriage made in heaven. So what are the chances of finding life on these planets, and what other bodies out there that might harbor life? These are a couple of the questions scientists are tackling in an upcoming Astronomy Days at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Rachel Smith is head of the Astronomy and Astrophysics Research Lab, curator of meteorites in the museum, and an associate professor at App State, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I love that you're a curator of meteors.
Yeah.
I envision you with a net, sort of standing on a very tall building.
Oh, yeah. It would be great.
Catching them and then bringing them in.
It would be great if it were that easy.
Well, it's hard enough just to do what, you know, figure out what to do with them when you're in their building. Hey, give us a sense of what this is, Astronomy Days. What are you doing?
Oh, okay. So Astronomy Days is a weekend event. It's every year, and it brings speakers from all over. We have an astronaut this year, Lee Morin, as well, which is great. And we have a lot of talks related to the theme of space telescopes and missions. And it's really fun for all ages, and we just hope to bring the excitement of astronomy and current research and space missions to the public. And it's a really fun and exciting event.
Is it harder to do these days? Here's why. Because when you talk about a telescope, of course, you're not looking at the thing anymore, are you? You're sort of analyzing data through these great, I mean, they're wonderful instruments, but we don't get to see. I mean, you can see a planet through a telescope.
Well, right. So the large telescopes, so I use Keck Telescope, which is in Hawaii right now, and we don't look through an eyepiece anymore, although we do offer that experience for visitors with our solar observing with smaller telescopes. But what you use is a computer interface. However, just being there, you know, we're part of this whole process of observing with these giant telescopes, a 10-meter telescope, and it's a real team effort, and it's it really is a hands-on experience in any event because you're operating the instrument and moving the telescope and just being part of these amazing observations. And so it's hands-on but on a keyboard.
On a keyboard. You're looking at young stars. Tell us about that.
Right. So I research forming stars in our galaxy, and it's actually a really exciting way to try to understand how planets form. And I'm observing the gas in front of the stars as they're forming, and this is part of the material that eventually should form planets, and we hope eventually to find out that also forms life, although we don't have any evidence for that specifically yet. So I'm looking at exciting objects. They're way beyond our solar system in many cases, and learning about this chemistry that goes into forming planets like our own. So to me, it's the most exciting work.
I'm gonna try to picture this now. You've got this young star. You're looking at the data, and then there's gas in front of the object that you would identify as that beginning star, right? That's the stuff that eventually may become a solar system. That stuff's going to coagulate and
It's like you imagine that, you know, dust bunnies is forming in your house. Uh-huh. So you have this spinning disk, kind of like pizza dough, around a kernel of a forming star, and as these the analogy would be like a dust bunny gets bigger and bigger, it pulls in more material. And so kind of the objects that pull in the most material have the most gravity and eventually will form planets. And we now know through other missions that most stars should have at least one planet, if not all stars, and maybe not like Earth necessarily, but it's a lot. There are a lot of planets out there. And so understanding these early processes and understanding this early material really helps build this big understanding of what's out in our galaxy and how unusual is our solar system. We really don't have a good sense of that now.
Yeah, that's the key, because I think there's a sense of how unique we are, which makes it for many people just impossible to imagine life other places. But if you think about the vastness, it's almost hard to think that there isn't.
Right.
And that's the stuff you're dealing with. But this question of being able to eyeball the planet and see the rings around Saturn, which again, you'll offer those opportunities, I guess, some of that.
During the day, we'll actually just have solar observing.
Yeah.
The hands-on opportunities for visitors will be observing our sun. Mm-hmm. During the day, we do sometimes have night evening activities, but just for this weekend, we'll be looking at the sun through specially outfitted telescopes, so a safe way to observe the sun. And you'll actually be able to see the sun, hopefully with good weather, we have as a big orange ball, because we have a special telescope that shows the hydrogen, and you can see these solar storms coming off the surface. So it's actually a really great appreciation of our star, which we need for, of course, we owe all of our existence to our own star. And so it gives visitors this kind of really hands-on experience of experiencing the sun that they wouldn't necessarily get every day.
Is it harder to sell astronomy? I mean, you're trying to bring people in and certainly generate some enthusiasm about this. I think there's a lot of excitement anyway. But in terms of the data and using computers, I would think digital natives might be as excited or not, and with the kind of work that you do. In other words, I can't really eyeball the thing, but wow, right. Isn't this cool? I'm using my knowledge of digital technology to tell a story.
Right. So I don't know. I feel like it's not a hard sell, at least I hope not for most people, to convey the excitement of doing research with state-of-the-art telescopes, which has a digital interface. I think people don't have a difficulty, at least in my experience, making the jump to what's really exciting about that. And that is the story of how solar systems form and understanding our own solar system. And at least from my experience and people I've spoken with, there is an inherent excitement about astronomy, what we can do, where we can go physically in the future with astronauts, and also just trying to understand if there's life out there. And I think that it's a really big human question. And if we discover any evidence for life beyond Earth, that would be the discovery of our entire species, really. And so we're all trying to understand this, astronomers in this field, this general umbrella of astrobiology and certain aspects of astronomy, trying to get at that question. And I do think that most people have an interest in knowing if there's any life beyond our own planet.
Is that something that you can tell, or at least tell, what are the conditions that are sort of at work and already visible when you're looking at these young stars and this little cloud of, if it's a cloud or a bulge of gas beyond its perimeter? Can you look at that and say, oh, well, now we can tell whether or not this offers the possibility for hospitality?
Right. That's a great question. And we're not there yet. So we can't really say something specific about if life will form in these systems. Mm. But and their model, people who build these big computer models are trying to answer that question and really connect the dots. And our research helps do that because I look at carbon specifically. And so carbon being the basis for organic molecules and the basis for all life as we know it helps build that picture of could this system with a lot of carbon, or, you know, understanding the chemistry and the ice and the gas really help us understand if life could form there? But we're not there yet to say these systems will have life. However, I will say that liquid water is the basis for life as well as we know it. And so there's water everywhere. And one thing that a lot of scientists are studying is this idea of habitability. And so understanding which planetary bodies have water, which moons have water, and this liquid water, and, you know, these missions going to various places in our solar system looking for this liquid water will help answer this question of habitability and possible life. And then eventually with the James Webb Space Telescope, see more specifically what are in these extra solar planetary systems, maybe these water worlds.
And those water worlds sometimes travel in the form of comets. Yep. I want to bring in another guest now who is probing the universe for clues to how planets become hospitable to life. Murthy Gudapati is a principal scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology, also a guest at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Astronomy Days, and he joins us now. Murthy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Frank. Good morning from California also.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll get that all worked out. That's an astronomical problem that we have yet to fix. But your work focuses on comets. So tell us more about comets and kind of how they're different than asteroids, for instance. That's my first question.
Yeah. Rachel has done an excellent job giving a lot of introduction to what I could say. When a solar system is under formation, which Rachel is studying, you have all the dust and gas that comes together and starts spiraling around the central heavy core. And as it does, we have planets forming, but there are some smaller bodies, which are about, kilometer-sized bodies, that are spared, especially when they are far away from the, forming sun. And these bodies actually contain the material that was there even before the formation of the pre-solar, nebula. And those are the precursor reservoirs for comets. For example, we have about 50 times the distance of Earth from the sun what we call it as the Kuiper Belt object reservoir that has probably millions and millions of cometary precursors. They are staying there waiting for something to happen that would pet up their path, either outwards or inwards. When they come inwards towards the sun, then they get captured into the sun's gravitational field and then become short period comets. And then beyond that, we also have what is called as Oort cloud, and that is almost like a snowball around our solar system. And comets also come from those places that have longer period of orbit. These are the comets that we see most of the times, and asteroids are much closer to the sun, and because of the temperature, the water content on the surface is mostly gone, and we see them as non-active small bodies.
So comets actually have more water, right?
Yeah, comets have more water, but asteroids also have water.
So this at least is some interesting possibilities on life on Earth and how it got here. And the comet is one suspect, or at least a player in one particular story about the development of life on Earth. Am I right?
Exactly. In fact, we have a lot of theories about how life started on Earth, and we still are far away from understanding or even proving how life started on Earth. But one of those theories is that during the formation of our solar system, which happened about 4.6 billion years ago, there was a period when there were, Jupiter and Saturn were not happy with their positions, and they were, having a tug of war, and one went away and other went closer, and so it scattered a lot of these small bodies around in our solar system, and many of them actually bombarded almost everything, including Moon and Earth and other bodies. This was supposed to have happened around 4 billion years ago, plus minus, 2 billion years. Plus minus 0.2 billion years. And interestingly, as soon after this had happened, life's traces are found on Earth. So carbon dating tells us that there was life on Earth around 4 to 4.2 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the key puzzles that are put together that indicates that comets would have brought the material that was necessary for life to have triggered on Earth.
That's a fascinating idea, is that we had much of what we needed here on Earth, but then you sort of bring in this outside elements that were formed in their own particular factories, just kind of standing by in these warehouses waiting to be propelled. Is there anything unique, because we can think about the Big Bang and sort of all this material blasting out, and it's all there, right? Everything that's here now was there then, but it gets reconstituted. So the stuff in the comet has really changed quite a bit and gone under a lot of metamorphosis, given the stresses and heats and temperatures and pressures. So it's a far, far different configuration of that stuff by the time it, say, got to Earth, right?
Actually, it is not. That is an interesting point, is that the Rosetta mission, which has ended, September 30th, by landing the Rosetta spacecraft on the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko, this is a ESA NASA mission, has provided us fantastic data. We never had it before. One of the data shows that the elements that we have, like oxygen in the form of oxygen molecules and nitrogen molecules, these are all very, very volatile molecules, and they were found in the comet coming out as outgas, which means that cometary interior should be very cold, probably around 50 Kelvin or even 30 Kelvin. That is, 50 Kelvin is, let's say, minus 223 degrees Celsius, and 30 is minus 243 degrees Celsius.
Wow, so you're talking, this is Buffalo in June, but go ahead.
They were formed long ago, even before our solar system was formed, and they were stored. Huh. And of course, you know, interestingly, they were also delivered to Earth, 4 billion years ago.
Fascinating stuff. And I've only given you about a minute for this, but I know you're very interested in work on exploring Jupiter's moons as well. Tell us more.
So, search for life, that is a big question. And NASA is doing, everything possible in our solar system and in extrasolar planets to understand two things. One is, are these bodies habitable? That is, do they have the right ingredients for life to, exist and survive and thrive? And second thing is there life anywhere else that we can understand, we can see? In order to do this, we are exploring in our own solar system almost every body that we think there could be life. Mars is one of those potential objects, and then in the outer planetary systems, Enceladus and Titan, that is Titan is Saturn's moon, and Europa is Jupiter's moon. And Europa, we have Galileo data. That shows that Europa has, though very, very frigid, icy crust, it has potentially a huge amount of liquid reservoir beneath and oceans beneath. So that's why we call them as ocean worlds. And it has the energy needed in terms of radiation and dynamo effect, and it has the mineral water contact needed to have minerals, and we have still not absolutely, certain whether we have organics there. If organic matter were to be there, which we, think there should be, then the potential for life in these oceans is very high.
Great stuff. And Murthy, I'm going to have to stop you right there, although I'd love to hear much, much more, but I want to thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Murthy Gudapati is a principal scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory at California's Institute of Technology. Rachel Smith, head of the Astronomy and Astrophysics Research Lab and curator of meteors for the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and associate professor at App State. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Astronomy Days runs from January 27th to the 28th at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. This is North Carolina Public Radio, and it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.